When it comes to finding meaning in life, sometimes you need to look no further than the simple pleasures that give us joy, like evening light, a bowl of wild strawberries, or a cup of great coffee. So why are you still drinking mediocre coffee? Life is too short to be settling for the stale coffee you get at the grocery store or your local cafe. It's time to make the switch to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But the best part is that they deliver this coffee to your home or office within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. They even offer autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So, plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hello and tack for tuning into the Next 100 Project, the never-ending podcast that glances back at classic filmer. Okay, that's enough Swedish. I probably didn't do any of those things right. Warning right now, spoilers are ahead. I am the host who's playing board games to keep death off my ass, Ryan Ellis, and with me is my Virgin Mary-like wife, Bev.
That's me.
She's even blonde. Wait, Virgin Mary's not blonde, is she? Well, in North America, she's probably blonde.
In Sweden, she certainly is.
Well, that's true. She would be, wouldn't she? Okay, the elaborate coming attraction trivia for this week's picture, The Seventh Seal, also known as, and I'm sure I'll pronounce this wrong too, Det Stund Inseglet. Not even close, probably. Okay, so name at least one of the movies Max von Sydow was in that were directed by the following legends: Martin Scorsese, Steven Spielberg, Woody Allen, David Lynch, Ridley Scott, John Huston, and George Stevens. Also, he's been in a Star Wars movie, a Bond movie, and a modern television juggernaut. Name those as well.
Okay, let's see how quickly I can do this. So, George Stevens was the greatest story ever told. Woody Allen, he was in Hannah and Her Sisters. John Huston, he was in Escape to Victory. Ridley Scott, Robin Hood. I forgot that he even made that movie. Spielberg, he was in Minority Report. Martin Scorsese, he was in Shutter Island. The Star Wars movie was The Force Awakens. The TV show was Game of Thrones. Oh, I forgot David Lynch. He was in Dune. Mm-hmm. And last but not least, Bond, Never Say Never Again.
Perfect. You could argue, when I say modern juggernaut, that he was a voice in The Simpsons at one point, but I was going for Game of Thrones. That's more modern, and it certainly is a juggernaut. You got them all. There may be other movies he was in by those directors, but they're the ones I wrote down. And you said Escape to Victory? I think it's just called Victory, the John Huston film.
Well, not according to IMDb.
One of those disputed title type movies. Okay, well, anyway, good job. The point is, the man has been in a lot of films with a lot of different types of people. He'll be 88 in April.
He's still working.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the Next 100 Project's 56th movie with movement, The Seventh Seal, was Swedish, so there could never be any love from the American Film Institute. Svensk Film Industry released the picture in Sweden 60 years ago in February 1957. Then it arrived in America in October 1958. All right, Bev, explain this 60-year-old picture with the skinny.
It's 14th century Sweden, and things are looking bleak for our hero, Max von Sydow's Antonius Block. He's returning home, disillusioned, from the Crusades with his squire Jan to find that the plague is ravaging their hometown. When death comes for Antonius, he challenges him to a chess match to buy time, hopefully enough time to perform one good act to give his life meaning.
I think he does that, maybe more than one. Or, in a nutshell, I see a lot of dead people.
And they're dancing.
Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers, 92% of the critics liked it, 49 fresh, 4 rotten, and 93% of audiences. The movie is 142nd on the IMDb's 250, and that Swedish title, Det Skund Inseglet, well, I guess actually it's the Seventh Seal part of it, comes from the Book of Revelation in the Bible. Not Revelations, Revelation. One more critical note, the Vatican loved it, I guess because it's about religion, even though it's a man who's searching for answers he's not getting. But then again, it's not decrying religion. It's just saying this guy wants to find something meaningful. He did something that was all about religion, going off to fight in the Crusades, but it's not working out for him.
And at the end of the movie, after all of his doubts and lamentations, he, of all the people dying at the end, is praying.
Yeah, one last supper and one last prayer, which may be falling on deaf ears. And according to the director Ingmar Bergman, all prayers are falling on deaf ears. I guess we kind of agree with that, don't we? Okay, then tell us your thoughts on our first ever Bergman film. Probably not our last ever Bergman film, though.
Pop culture would give you the impression that watching The Seventh Seal is homework. the image of Von Sydow playing chess with death on a bleak, rocky beach is shorthand for exhausting, pretentious art films. But, guys, The Seventh Seal is so accessible. Even at 60 years old, it still feels exhilarating. There's no expiry date on a great, thoughtful exploration of existential dilemmas. And even as I say that, I know I'm making it sound like a total chore, but I can't exaggerate how much it's not. It's funny, it's entertaining, it's interesting.
It's funny?
It has its moments, absolutely.
Oh, I guess the married couple.
I mean, Jan is certainly funny. And well, Diaf and Mia are cute, at least. They're charming and entertaining.
Yeah, Niels Popp and B.B. Anderson. B.B. Anderson worked with Bergman so many times. She was dating him at that point. And the first time they show her, she's wearing white. Probably never looked better in her life. She's the other woman in Persona, along with Bergman regular Liv Ullmann. Well, they're both Bergman regulars, really. Yeah, I guess you're right. There's some humor there. There's some humanity there, for sure. The only people that ever see death as personified by, what's his name, Bent Ekarot? He was actually in the stage play that this is based on that Bergman wrote, and that was called Wood Painting. They performed that on radio and on the stage. But the only two people that can see death are Bloch and Joff, or Joff, probably mispronounced a lot of the names in this podcast.
I think they call him Joff.
And he also sees the Dance of Death at the end, but his wife never sees any of those fantastical elements. That's another thing about this film. I guess that's not exactly a secret. If you know anything about it, it's got a fantasy element right down to somebody playing chess with death.
Yeah, it's not all that grounded in reality. A lot of people have pointed out that it's not very historically accurate. A lot of the things that take place in the movie didn't take place at the same time as history. You know, the Crusades ended well before the plague ravaged Sweden, and the flagellation movement and the witch hunts didn't come till much later in Swedish history, but they put all these things together to make it the bleakest possible time to be alive in Sweden. But yeah, there's also the completely fantastic elements like death playing chess, like Joff's visions. The very first things he sees is the Virgin Mary playing with baby Jesus.
Yeah, and then he and Mia end up playing Joseph and Mary on stage, and then they have this Joseph and Mary and then Jesus with their baby kind of arc.
Joff and Mia are Swedish for Joseph and Mary.
Exactly, yeah, that's also true. It wouldn't take much to make this a horror movie. Not just because of death, but because of the portrayal of everything in the film, all the surrealistic elements. If you edited the trailer a certain way, you could certainly do, like they do in the modern version, The Shining, that becomes the rom-com, make this movie that is definitely dour, and I do not really fully agree with you that it's entertaining, but take this movie that's a downer in so many ways and make it be a flat-out terrifying experience, at least in the trailer. Maybe you can't recut the movie that way. One thing about this movie I think is also very true, it didn't really need dialogue, and some of it is pretentious. It comes across maybe more so pretentious now because this movie's been imitated so many times, and because Bergman was coming into his own around this time. He did Wild Strawberries, one of his more well-known films, this exact same year. He still had some of the other ones yet to come, like Cries and Whispers, we've talked about that. Persona was also after this. But the drama that's mixed with surreality and the very dark fantasy, the meaninglessness of life, according to Bloch, at least at some point, and the inevitability of death, takes us to the religious themes, and that would be the overarching theme in so many of Bergman's work. The silence of God, it said, is what he called it. His father was very religious, and he grew up in that religious household, of course. It sounds like Bergman himself wanted to have faith, but just couldn't. Maybe just at some point, kind of like me, where I was never a faithful person, but I was interested in religion. I definitely love the stories. I still find the stories interesting, and a lot of them are good life lessons. My biggest problem with it is the thing you just talked about a minute ago. It's things like flagellation. It's things like feeling bad about this. It's things like going to kill somebody because they have a different god than you do. That's what I hate. When you see stuff like in Nashville, we talked about that in that podcast, where they're singing to God in the opening, the great comparison between the black choir that's having fun with religion and the overbearing Haven Hamilton, not really religious so much, more about just nationalism, but being so much of an asshole in that sequence where he's berating the piano player. That's one of the better examples of showing that religious belief can be fun in Nashville. And in this movie, showing it's all about pain and awfulness.
I don't disagree, because I think you're right about all those things, but I would also add that the movie's message, faith, is just a way for us to be okay with death. All it does is assuage our fears about death and lack of control that we have in our lives, and it's really just about comforting us from all the horrors of humanity, and particularly in a time and place like this movie. And there have been times and places like this in history where it's just as bleak as you can imagine, and it's a terrible time to be alive. And I think one of the main purposes of religion is to just give people purpose. I'm not a lifelong atheist, but my entire adulthood, since I was a teenager, I've been an atheist. part of the reason I love movies like this is because I do, as an atheist, really struggle with wishing that I had meaning. I'm a devout atheist, as I like to say, but that doesn't mean that I don't wish there were a God. Like, it doesn't mean that I don't see the appeal in the notion of a paternal God who looks over us, who makes decisions and guides us and gives our life meaning. I would love that to be true, but much like Antonius Bloch, I just cannot accept it because I want it to be true. And that's what he struggles with. He wishes he could have faith.
Yeah, like Bergman did. And supposedly doing this film helped Bergman get over his death phobia. He dealt with death an awful lot in his films. Woody Allen, one of his biggest fans, certainly had that as a theme in his films. He, of course, almost always did comedies. He did do Interiors, which was a very Bergman-esque kind of film. But generally, Woody had drama mixed with comedy or a flat-out comedy. He did do a movie called Love and Death, which definitely stole from this one. But getting back to the thing about faith and the lack of it that people might have like us, there's a line in the movie where negative images, and thoughts for that matter, make people run to their priests. And I don't like that for the obvious reasons I just said a minute ago, that that's a negative thing. It's not about celebrating some being you're never going to see. Well, maybe you are going to see, but you don't know you're going to see. It's more about being terrified and having somebody tell you the way to live. And there have been plenty of people that benefit from that, but an awful lot of other people that haven't. And then they go down the road of condemning somebody for witchcraft. That's one of the good acts that Bloch does do. He comforts an afflicted person. He tries to help her. She dies anyway, but he does the best he can to make her feel better in the short time she has left. Very Christ-like.
So is he comforting her, or is he just trying to satisfy his curiosity because he believes that she might have conversed with the devil, made congress with the beast, and he wants to know if she's learned anything that he doesn't know?
Well, maybe that's what it is, but at least he's talking to her like she's a human being. He's not treating her like she's about to... Well, she is about to die, but it's not his fault. He's trying to do something for her.
He's also about to die, so he has nothing to lose.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here's a sidebar in the whole thing. The beginning of the film, are Bloch and you said Jan, are they dead? They're laying on the rocks. They see mostly death through the whole picture, well, at least Bloch does. And if they're not dead at the beginning, if this movie's not suggesting that, and then this is all just one bad dream, if you will, one moment before dying, are Bloch and Jan responsible for bringing death and the plague to Sweden? That plays in what we talked before about Walking Dead, how the main characters, our heroes, wherever they go, they bring death and destruction more than was there before. So are these two guys who've gone off to do what they think is a good deed come back and are killing all kinds of people, maybe not literally, but figuratively, including Bloch going back to his wife, who he left to go fight for in the Crusades, not fighting for her literally, but fighting for his homeland is what he probably thought he was doing. And then when he comes back, sees her for a matter of minutes, it looks like, or maybe a few hours, and then she and those other people in that house are dead.
Yeah, it's possible if she had taken off, then she would have been spared. I mean, probably not. I don't know what became of the people that ran from the plague and probably were met with the plague in other towns, or brought it to other towns, more likely. But yeah, you may be right. Death comes for them before he comes for everybody else, so it's possible they were meant to die first, but instead death gives them a reprieve, and maybe they're the ones that spread it to all of their companions.
The other good deed that Bloch does in the film is he tries to help Joff and Mia escape, and that's a self-sacrifice kind of thing. Again, very Christ-like. Maybe that's his good deed, that if he's not actually helping the witch, then that would be his good deed.
So why do you think it's important that Joff and Mia are the ones that survive? What do you think it is that makes them worthwhile of living or deserving of living or the ones that you would root for?
He probably feels bad about having gone off to kill people for his beliefs. He doesn't have a kid. They have a young baby. They are a picture of happiness. They're also doing something, and this may be pretentious, but they're actors. So there's the pointless necessity of art in our lives.
Well, I mean, Bergman, of course he would respect actors and acting troupe putting on plays and entertaining people. This was a play originally, so you can't deny that he would have respect for that kind of art form, although he seems to treat them very lightly. They don't take themselves seriously. One of the most important parts of the film where Antonius finds peace, at the very least, is when he's spending time with Joff and Mia. They've picked some wild strawberries and they have fresh milk, and they share it with him, and they're just sitting in the sunshine in the evening. Everything is lovely in this moment. It's a good day. He's with good people. He's enjoying himself, and he has a speech about living in this contentment and experiencing this and knowing that this alone can sustain a life, that this is what the meaning of life is. Mia also has a speech where she says, you know, days are good. Summer's better than winter, but you just have to live, and you have to live day by day, and you have to be happy. And they are very happy-go-lucky. More than any other characters in the film, they really live in the moment. They don't seem to have religion themselves, although they talk about it and he has these visions, but he doesn't let it trouble him. He doesn't, like, let it take over his life. He doesn't seem to want to share it with other people or use it to be a leader of men and to influence other people. He just kind of sees them, he tells his wife about them, and then he goes about his happy life. So my interpretation of that is it's Bergman's way of saying living life one day at a time and enjoying the present is the meaning of life.
Live in the now!
Yes.
As Garth said in Wayne's World. I like how earlier on, Death is a con artist because he pretends he's a priest and he learns about a move that Block will use in one of the, not later games, it's the same game, but when they pick up the game later on. I said about it could be a horror film. That could have been a comedy moment, but they didn't play it for laughs. And that is one of the most iconic shots in cinema, the knight playing chess with Death. And they do play chess in many different locations, but the one people think about is the one by the water. And of all the movies we've covered the last long while, maybe all the movies we've ever covered, more than 200 now, well, as we said, not really 200 movies, but 200 podcasts. All-time famous images, homaged images, this is up there near the top.
Oh yeah, when you are going to portray Death in a film, I think this is the starting point of the image that you're going to draw from, because everybody's copied it, and of course every time it's copied, it's changed, it's evolved, but this is kind of the starting point.
And they got the look of Death from paintings. We see paintings that are dealt with when Yalm is talking to that dude in the church, I guess it is.
Yeah, he says, a skull is more interesting than a naked woman.
And in their chess game, of course, leads to the end, suggesting that Block lost, although it was always a distraction anyway. And when Yon lets Death in, he lies about it. So you could say it's a blessing that Death has come, because they literally seem to welcome him. Time to expire.
Some of them more than others, especially the servant woman who's crying with joy that she finally gets to die.
Well, the one who's credited as the girl, Gunnel Lindholm, I guess is her name. She was in The Silence and Virgin Springs, so she did a lot of things with Bergman. Most people involved in the cast and crew worked with Bergman more than once. She was also in the Swedish version of Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, so she's still working even now. But she has her only line in the film in that sequence where she says, "It is finished." And it is said that Jesus' last words on the cross were supposedly either, "It is finished," or "It is accomplished." In The Last Temptation of Christ, he says, "It is accomplished." And then we get to the Dance of Death at the end with the non-actors. There was a great cloud Bergman wanted to get, and the actors were out of their costumes. I guess they were dismissed for the day, so they just got some stagehands to go do that. And they're so far away, it doesn't really matter who they are.
Yeah, some people, when they're interpreting the film, question why certain characters appear to be missing from the Dance of Death, and it probably has more to do with just who was available on set at the time.
That is why.
Yeah, throw on some costumes and go up there and dance. You're not supposed to look that closely.
Well, could you really tell?
I wouldn't have even thought to count. I just assume it was the group and not be like, is that a skirt or is it pants? There's somebody playing like a saxophone or something. Honestly, someone well, playing an instrument.
Well, in that sequence, there's the seven figures in the Dance of Death. And the recurring number seven, and much of the dialogue seven is mentioned. Of course, the name of the movie, The Seventh Seal.
So let's talk about why the movie's called Seventh Seal. The Seven Seals refers to Revelation, as you said, and it refers to the seven symbolic seals that secure the book seen by, you'll know this better than me, John of Patmos.
I don't know that
better. In his Revelation of Jesus Christ. All right, I clearly don't know it that well either. The opening of the seals marks the apocalypse and the second coming of Jesus Christ. And the seals contain secret information known only by God. And, of course, Antonius, through the whole film, is trying to learn about God and being denied. God is silent. So with each of the seals, it's like the cataclysmic events, the horsemen, wrath, earthquakes. But the seventh seal is the last one. It brings the judgment. And they say when they open the seventh seal, the heavens were silent for half an hour. It's been interpreted different ways, but it's not really all that clear in the Bible what that means, what that silence is about. Some people say it's just God contemplating. Some people say it's to, like, really mess with people.
And that is something that Bergman did over and over again, the silence of God. Before we get into the cast and the crew and everything, I asked that question. I don't think you really gave me an answer what you thought about Block and Yon being dead at the beginning. And the movie is one of those that's suggesting all of this isn't not real. And it is a surrealistic movie, so it doesn't even have to be real anyway.
Yeah, it's true. It's a surrealistic movie. But I would say in film language, they're still technically alive.
But they're laying there like they're dead.
I know, they really are. I wonder how they got there in the first place. That maybe there was a shipwreck, or maybe they were already sick or something.
I like how Death is shown, too. He's just there, and there's no big music stinger. It's not some dramatic thing. He's just standing there on the beach and puts out the arm to have the cloak go out, you know, almost like a vampire would. And speaking of vampires, one of our more recent films, our last foreign film, we've covered a few of them already this year, and Spirited Away was actually a foreign film, too. But Nosferatu, our most recent foreign film, had the plague in it as well. And the title character absolutely is representing the plague.
I like the way that Death is portrayed, that he's not creepy, that he's, well, he is creepy, but he's not scary. He's just inevitable. Mm-hmm. He's just there. He's unflappable. People try to trick him. They beg from him. But he can be patient because he has never failed to collect his charge. We have the good fortune to live in a time and place where it's unlikely we'll die young, but death is patient and we won't escape any more than Antonius did, or who is it who climbs the tree and he cuts the tree down? I love that image. Yeah. He's never ever lost and he knows it.
I like how in the stages of grief, bargaining is one of them, and the famous chess scene is bargaining, really. It happens right off the bat, too, rather than, what is it, denial is the first one, I guess, or is it the first one? Anger, maybe, is the first one? Acceptance denial is first. Definitely the last one, and of course they accept.
It's all been debunked now, anyway.
But no, but it is a famous expression, the stages of grief. Acceptance is definitely the last one, and our characters seem to accept death, but bargaining, I don't think, is one of the first one or two, and yet it happens right away in the film with Block and death.
Well, perhaps he skips denial because he's been coming from the Crusades 10 years. It very much disillusioned him, changed him into a different person. When he meets his wife again, he talks about how she won't know him, how he won't know her, how what a different person he is coming home than when he left. Because he saw a lot of death. He caused a lot of death. And
he was in the shit.
And he needs to have faith because he needs to believe that he went down south to a strange land to kill people for a good reason, for the right reason, which we all know it wasn't.
Well, and they always avoid calling it a crusade in the modern era. I think Bush said the word crusade and someone, no.
Walk that back.
Do not even suggest that at all.
It wasn't a proud time in history.
So this is Max von Sydow's first film with Bergman. They did 13 together in total. He has faith issues here, but he's full of faith in The Exorcist, which is probably still his most famous role. Because I mentioned those other films he did with those people. In a lot of the cases, those movies are not the director's best or most notable. Shutter Island, Minority Report, on and on. Good pictures in a lot of cases, but not their most notable ones. But The Exorcist is certainly William Friedkin's most notable film. Gunnar Bjornstrand, who plays Jon, the squire. He was in Persona and Wild Strawberries, so some of the best and best-known movies by Bergman. I think the squire seems like he should be in charge between the two of them, him and the knight. He's brawnier, he's the natural leader, and yet he seems to be the one who has to take orders. But he doesn't really seem to take orders. He's more the leader of the two, I thought.
Yeah, and he seems to have contempt for him. They could have this Don Quixote and, what's his sidekick's name, Pancho?
Sancho Panza.
Sancho
Panza.
What Ryan said. It seems like they could have that kind of vibe, but they actually don't have that many scenes together. They don't have many conversations with each other. I get the impression by the end of the film that Jon has no patience for Antonius. And first of all, his crusade, he didn't want to go with him on the crusades. Second, his whole crisis of faith. He's kind of a more, I guess, resilient character of the two of them and tougher. Certainly more cynical and funnier, too.
Mm.
But also kind of a dick. Mean to all the women.
Well, speaking of women, B.B. Anderson is, I guess, the female lead in the film. She's got the most screen time of all the ladies. I think she does, anyway. You haven't seen Persona, right? Or have you seen
it?
Okay, because that's the one I think people would think about her the most in all the Bergman films she did, and she's damn good in that one. So that brings us to the director and the writer, Bergman. He struggled to get this movie made, and he later called it uneven.
Yeah, on paper, it kind of looks like something that could have come from the mind of, like, a first-year film student with a philosophy minor. Anything but subtle. It doesn't ask the viewer to infer meaning. Characters blurt out exactly what could and perhaps should be conveyed through allegory and metaphor. But while the frankness could kind of be its downfall, and I think to a lot of people it is its downfall, I feel like the film's good enough to make it work. I don't know how it finds the balance. Maybe it's a little bit of forgiveness on my part because it's so old. But certainly by the standards of other films in the 50s.
Well, I don't think a lot of other movies from anywhere, certainly not Hollywood films, were doing anything like this. So we can talk about it not working so well now, 60 years later. Of course it doesn't, because other films, Woody Allen himself, a big filmmaker for that matter, not just student films like you said, or people writing stuff about Bergman, all that would have exhausted all this stuff to death. But back then it would have been fresh and new. So he was setting up the cliches he could be accused of using.
In the 50s, I think it's important to mention that it was still radical to question the existence of God. Now it would seem more radical to just have this kind of earnestness that the film presents in the question. That would seem stranger. In the 50s, it was scandalous to talk like this.
And his characters literally ask faith questions he himself must have asked. So I think that's one of the reasons why you have such literal questions about, where are you, God? Maybe he doesn't quite say that, but he might as well.
I find the film refreshing because it just puts these questions out there. Doesn't everybody think these things, but rarely talk about them outside of when you are a high first-year philosophy student? I like dwelling on these things. It's rare that a piece of art just kind of this shamelessly talks about death.
Because it's not a fun topic.
I don't say I find it fun, but I find it bottomlessly interesting.
Bergman's producer was Alan Eckeland. He produced several Bergman films, and then his crew, cinematographer Gunnar Fischer, who shot the 1371 DVD, which looks pretty nice. I thought it was going to look worse than it did. The Blu-ray would look great, but we don't have that. Fischer is a Bergman guy before Sven Nykvist became his cinematographer, and then Nykvist was picked up by Woody Allen for many of his pictures. The editor, Leonard Wallen, he cut 165 movies in total, but was dead 10 years later. And the music, Eric Nordgren, another Bergman regular. I mentioned editing, so of course that's your thing. The movie is pretty short. It's not even an hour and 40 minutes long. What did you think about the look and then the pacing and the music for that matter?
I think it's fair to maybe criticize this, although this is probably at a script level, that there's no real dramatic drive to the film. It's just a series of vignettes and soliloquies, and whether that's something that could have been fixed in post, it's pretty hard to say, but it probably was a problem on script level. You say you didn't find this film that engaging, so actually I'm curious to hear what you think about it, because while I found it entertaining, you said you wouldn't call it entertaining.
No, that's exactly true. I was engaged by it, but I wasn't entertained by it.
Well, aren't those the same things? Isn't that just two sides of the same coin?
Because I'm thinking about entertainment on the level of fun. That's what has to always be fun.
Oh, yeah,
fun.
It doesn't really take you away. You don't get wrapped up in the plot at any point. It's not an adventure story in any way. It's not plot-driven whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the influence, and of course, there's a ton of it. We talked about the chess scene image. That's by far the most famous thing from this film, from a look standpoint, and probably from a story standpoint, for that matter, too. Bergman was influenced by Kurosawa Pictures. He predated Bergman by not that many years, but they're two of the most famous foreign filmmakers of all time. One of the better-known images, although the movie wasn't a huge hit, but it's a goofy, fun comedy, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, where they play games with death first as chess, but then it becomes Battleship and Twister and a lot of other things, and that's a lot of fun. And, of course, they win. They end up beating death. Best 3 out of 5! Best 4 out of 7!
It's like a pretty mediocre movie, but that scene alone, the stuff with death, is really hysterical. Mm-hmm. Definitely the best part of the movie.
Mm-hmm. And then looking at a death figure entering a room, which is what happens right towards the end of this picture, is also very nicely done in A Prairie Home Companion. So I think that had to have been something that Robert Altman was homaging. And isn't that interesting that that was Altman's last film? He must have been seeing death in his own way. I mean, Bergman certainly wasn't. He was still fairly young, and he lived a long time after this movie. I think he only died not that many years ago, actually. So at least about 50 more years after the movie was made. But Altman had one of his very last images in A Prairie Home Companion be death coming from these people who don't look scared. They don't look happy about it either. They're just interested. They're curious. But they're also together. The 5 or 6 of them at that booth in their diner in A Prairie Home Companion are together, just like our characters in The Seventh Seal at least can go together.
So on top of the really specific influences, it has some vague and overarching influences. The look of it, the high contrast cinematography, and just kind of the bleakness and the allegorical nature of it. And it's been credited, along with the beat movement and jazz music, for breaking that stale Hollywood culture out of its studio rut. It was this pillar of cinema as an art form. I guess at the time there was a dearth. There certainly wasn't in Hollywood. MGM wasn't making movies like this. Swedish critics were kind of hard on it, but apparently it blew up in America. It was maybe not a hit, but it was a cult hit. And a lot of people like Woody Allen and like a lot of other filmmakers, it blew their minds. It was incredibly refreshing to them. So I guess a lot of films weren't really being made like this at the time. It was something that was brand new, and it's hard to imagine it that way now because it's been copied so much.
All right, the brief awards and list section. The movie won a special jury prize at Cannes in 1957. And Bergman, over his entire career, was nominated for 9 Oscars, 3 for directing. He won the Thalberg Award in 1971, but he was not nominated for anything for this picture and wasn't even nominated for the Foreign Language Film Oscar, which seems shocking now.
Yeah, did Sweden even put it? Oh, Sweden did put it up, but they didn't select it for the
nominees.
As
one of the 5, yeah. And Wild Strawberries was at the same calendar year. But then again, they're going to base it on when it got released in Hollywood, and that would have been 1958 for Seventh Seal. I'm not sure when Wild Strawberries went to America. May have been 59 or 60 for all we know. A lot of times movies took years to get to Hollywood and then it would qualify for foreign language Oscars. Sometimes you'll see a movie, we'll say 1952 or something, when it came out, because they'll base it on when it was first released anywhere, but then it wins the foreign language Oscar in 1957, yeah, whatever it might be. All right, well, last thoughts on The Seventh Seal.
So I may be speaking for myself, but I still find it radical and refreshing to watch a film that shamelessly dwells on death. It's probably not for everybody, but if you also find a skull more interesting than a naked woman, Don't let this movie's unearned pretentious reputation stop you from enjoying it.
I like the naked woman thing way more than the skull. But I know what they're saying. I get what they're saying and I respect it. I don't mean to be slagging the movie. If I sound like I was, then I apologize. I didn't mean to not be enthusiastic about the movie. It's one of the greats, and that's why we chose to do it. We were maybe going to do it last year and have a whole run. Seven Samurai, Seven, and Seven Seal. But we decided not to do two foreign language films in 3 weeks. But like I said, we've done three foreign language films already this year with this Nosferatu and, in effect, Spirited Away.
You must kind of like it, because I watched it on your recommendation a couple of years ago before we considered
it. I do like it. I'm saying I like it.
Yeah. And you own it. You own the Criterion version, mm-hmm. So it's true.
I think his best movies, even though this one's probably more well-known, the best ones for me, Cries and Whispers, and I guess this actually is not an arguable point for a lot of people, but Persona. That would be the peak for him for a lot of people, I guess. I'm not really breaking new ground there, but I think Cries and Whispers is the one you got to see the most. But definitely not entertaining in the usual way either, and harder than this one is to watch in a complimentary way, I'll say that. We've been talking about that one for years, and one of these days we'll watch it and probably cover it for the podcast. All right, so in Seven Sunrises, the 2017 Major League Baseball season will have just begun, so we'll take a look at a 25-year-old baseball movie. A League of Their Own. Girls can't play baseball, la 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 la. One of the best moments of the whole film is when the shortstop hits that guy and with the ball who's dogging them for trying to play baseball. Fucking idiot, why would you pay a ticket and then not like something?
Well, I'm giving away that we've already watched the movie, but it's lovely, but it's not subtle.
No, two straight non-subtle films, maybe more than two straight. What was the one before this? Saturday Night Fever, also not very subtle. Okay, well, since we've watched this, maybe you'll get this one right away. The Coming Attraction Trivia for A League of Their Own. How many American states are represented for those four teams in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League?
So, for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast about A League of Their Own. And in the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. We've covered over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. And while you're there, please rate us and review us. It helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Want to go play some chess?
Okay, but you have to let me win. I'm going to match my bishop and my knight.
Does that mean I die if you win? I don't know how that works. Anyway, it is finished.
And cut.